welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam's still on his summer break, and so you get me, Becky Friedman, in the studio. I am pleased to have Nathan for the first time in a while. How are you?
Not too much of a while.
Not too much of a while? Maybe a few weeks or so.
Yeah.
And welcome back from last week, Justin.
Hey.
So we talked about some very unseasonable things last week on Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. And we got a little follow-up. I don't know if you're aware of this, Justin, but Maynard from Australia writes to us and says, "Thank you, Ask an Atheist, for introducing me to the timeless Christmas classic Dominic the Donkey."
You are very welcome.
"And his very timely Elvis the Presley for President, a concept last explored in Bones of Elvis by Inner City Unit. Enjoying the journey all of you take me on every week. Regards, Maynard."
Buy the ticket, take the ride.
Well, that was in reference to a listener question of asking a bunch of atheists what your favorite Christmas song is. So I figured I'd pass it your way, Nathan. Do you have a Christmas song that you are, as an atheist, most partial to?
I mean, I grew up, as I've mentioned before, in the Lutheran church. So, you know, we're very Bach heavy. With, you know, Mighty Fortress and all those other things, non-Christmas songs. But as far as Christmas songs go, I'm still a huge fan of Bing Crosby and his Christmas album. The best Christmas album of all time is probably Chicago, because it sounds like Chicago and it sounds like a Christmas album. So that's an interesting,
like the musical Chicago.
Yeah,
he had, like, it coming.
No, as in the band, you know.
Oh, okay,
right. that one's an interesting one.
Not, and the Broadway theater production.
The rock band.
Okay.
And I'm, you know, Green Sleeves is still Christmas.
Well, you're also a classical musician yourself.
Yeah,
vocalist.
I still sing, namely Christian music, all the time, because that's all that's available in the classic genre almost exclusively. So,
yeah. So more atheists that can still appreciate and be moved by Christmas music, whether it's about a silly donkey that can't climb Italian hillsides, or, you know, something with a bit more.
But no, the donkey can climb the hillsides. Oh, the reindeer can't climb,
right, the flying reindeer can't climb the hillsides.
Put some respect on Dominic's name.
Yeah. Well, at Ask an Atheist Sam Mulvey, where you can write us at questions@atheist.radio. We'd love to field any of your questions or feedback from things that we've discussed in the past or annoyed you with or introduced you to, and so we definitely appreciate questions from all listeners, including Maynard from Australia. So we're super happy to hear from you. You know, speaking of music, though, there's two things that came across my radar. One was a few weeks ago, where singer Avril Lavigne is receiving blowback from Christian fans after releasing stills from the music video for her single "I Fell in Love with the Devil," which was released in February. Christians who flocked to the pop star in light of her prayerful "Head Above Water" song were furious at Lavigne's seeming turnabout. "Head Above Water" had been interpreted as a move that the mainstream artist was veering into Christian territory with lyrics like "God, keep my head above water, don't let me drown, it gets harder, I'll meet you there at the altar as I fall down to my knees." Her new song contrasts with lyrics that include "I fell in love with the devil, and now I'm in trouble, I'm underneath his spell," and then a bridge that plays "Angels and devils always fight over me, take me to heaven, wake me up from this dream."
I don't really understand what their problem is with this. Like, they flocked to her for the "Head Above Water" song with the perception that she was moving more into Christian music territory. And then isn't the, like, I listened to "Fell in Love with the Devil." It's kind of catchy. I mean, it's an Avril Lavigne song. I'm a fan from back in the day, but it still is in the same basic kind of genre as the "Head Above Water." Like, is that not about, like, the temptation of sin?
And isn't the devil a character found in the Bible.
Well, yeah, I think that they were most freaked out by the stills from the music video, because she's, instead of head above water, where she's in like flowy sort of angelic white clothing, she's dressed all in black and carrying a big cross.
Oh no.
Because no one ever
she's dressed like a priest?
Yeah, no one. It's terrible. It's a totally unchristian thing to be dressed all in black robes and carry a cross.
Nobody tell the Orthodox priests.
I guess it's only bad if you're a girl and you're wearing super heavy smoky eyeshadow.
Oh, yeah, that's probably it.
Maybe the smoky eye has something to do.
Yeah. So, you know, there's everything to freak out about over music, but at least we're not in Lebanon, where a music festival has axed a popular indie band from the lineup in light of an escalating campaign launched by church leaders who accused the group of blasphemy. The Biblos International Festival canceled Mashru Leila's appearance, reportedly to avoid bloodshed at the event, after criticism from clergy and politicians morphed into threats of physical violence, with social media posts threatening to shower the band with bullets or otherwise stop the festival by force. The band is known for pushing social boundaries in the Arab world, with a gay lead singer and songs that tackle issues like LGBT rights, environmentalism, women's rights, and politics. The band expressed genuine regret towards anyone who felt that their creed and beliefs were targeted by their songs, and asserted that their lyrics do not breach sacraments or faiths, while adding at the same time that their respect for others' beliefs was as firm as their respect for the right to be different.
Oh, boy. Well, I guess it's on balance better behavior from the Avril Lavigne fans rather than the these guys who were threatening to shower the band with bullets. I mean, that's...
Although this band has kind of already succeeded in a large way. I mean, if you're able to create that amount of controversy and visceral reaction, that's well on your way toward... You know,
well, you're making your point heard, and you're getting your music played.
Right.
They aren't any stranger to controversy. I mean, they've been banned from Jordan. They've been banned from Egypt because at one of their performances, they raised a pride flag. And
oh no,
yeah,
and there are no gay people in the Middle East.
Nope. Well, at least not in Egypt.
Oh, boy.
So an interesting thing here is that the festival actually. You know, canceled their appearance in conjunction with the band because the band didn't want, you know, people's lives threatened. You know, their music is less important than people's lives. And so I'm appreciative of that. And with, you know, with the internet, there's no way that, you know, people are going to be barred from hearing them anyway.
Yeah, there's only a certain number of resources that a music festival is going to have to dedicate towards providing security for not only the band, but the concert goers. And it is very good that they were able to look at that in a very practical way and be like, hey, this might very well be an issue. It's just unfortunate that it even had to be an issue in the first place.
What's also amazing here is that initially, it was conservative politicians and clerics that were saying this band is horrible and this band is blasphemous and this band, you know, offends religious sensibilities. And from the politicians and clerics' voices of that, it escalates into just general citizens then commenting direct threats on Facebook and through other social media. And it's a real potent example of how you know, rhetoric can incite other kinds of escalated you know, actions and opinions by people, and can really spark this hatred that would motivate people to look at, you know, public shootings at music festivals.
You're right. Yeah, one of the things that was referenced in the NYT link was about a painting, a Photoshop job of Madonna as the Virgin Mary, I believe. And that was like one of the images that was being brought up as being blasphemous. But that was from years ago. You know what hasn't been happening from the years ago when this image was first posted and circulated and now? people haven't been getting hurt by it. So it's like, now it's like, oh, now it's a problem. Now we're going to be angry about it. And we're just going to disregard the whole, nobody was getting harmed in the intervening 4 years. Well, yeah.
Has it only been 4 years?
Now it's an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, when we think about creative outlets and music and production, those boundary pushing moments, whether they be Avril Lavigne, you know, dressing up in either gothy or angelic flowy robes for her music videos, or whether it's raising a rainbow flag at a concert in Egypt and getting permanently banned from entering your country. There's a real power that art and music has to push those social boundaries. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad for them to exist and to have that. And I really like what they stated about, you know, we are firm in our respect for people's beliefs and, you know, and religion and stuff like that, but equally as firm in our respect for the right to be different. And to have a frontman of an indie band that is very different and out and gay in the Middle East, super popular. All of their lyrics are in Arabic.
Right.
And so they're popular in much of the Arabic speaking world. They've even been in the U.S. and had sold out shows in the U.S.
Something else that I thought that was interesting about this, if I remember the demographics of Lebanon correctly, it's a majority Muslim country. And these death threats are coming from the Christian minority, Catholic minority?
There's a fair number of Christian individuals that live in the Middle East and Lebanon in particular.
Right.
So it's
they're it's not a majority Christian country, correct? Am I remembering that the right way?
I am not. I don't have the figures off the top of my head. But you can also think of the Christian clerics being more vocal, since they are a minority, mm-hmm. and so feeling the need to protect one's values, might explain a little bit why they're so outraged, but it certainly doesn't explain, the reason that you would incite other people to be violent towards musicians just expressing themselves.
Right. Yeah, I would think that if you're in a position where other people can harm you, you wouldn't immediately turn around and then start threatening to harm other people.
Well, you'd think. I think we'll talk a little bit more about that and what those fear reactions and of perceived persecution and perceived minority status might incite. But we'll be back after the break. We'll be talking to an old friend of Ask an Atheist. Welcome back to Ask an Atheist, where you can email us your questions at questions@atheist.radio or tweet us at Ask an Atheist WA or find us on Facebook at the same place or give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. I am so pleased to welcome back a guest that we've had on Ask an Atheist before, and that is Joseph Richardson. He joins us from Florida. He is an active member of the Central Florida Freethought community, working on a variety of projects that include secular invocations, park cleanups, and social and educational events. He and his wife recently returned from a humanitarian trip to the border town of McAllen, Texas, volunteering to support sheltered migrants applying for residency and asylum in the U.S. Welcome back, Joseph.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back. Glad to talk to you again.
So, start us off. Tell us about your trip.
Yeah, well, it was... I'll start with the kind of the motivation for the trip. I think as with so many people, you see what's going on in the news and there's kind of a desire to help out and a lack of knowledge as to what to do to help out. And, both my wife and I kind of experienced this and as we're watching the news and like a couple of weeks after this discussion that we had, I found out that a local pastor had gone down to McAllen, Texas to kind of survey the situation and see for himself what was going on. He tried to get into the detention center and wasn't able to. But he did hook up with a Catholic Charities shelter, where I think all, if not, you know, almost all, if not all, of the people who are coming out of the detention center go through this shelter in order to get things like a change of clothes, get a bus ticket to wherever their sponsor is, just kind of like reset after getting out of the detention center, have some food and stuff like this. So anyway, so he found out about that. He came back to Central Florida area here to Winter Garden, and he said we got to do something. We're going to organize a drive to collect all of these clothes and diapers and toothbrushes and toothpaste and soap to send out there. And we're going to take some people down there who can also see for themselves what's going on. And we're going to volunteer for a couple of days to do this. So when my wife and I found out about this, we thought that was a really good idea. And we joined with him, even though my wife is actually Christian. As you know, I am an atheist, of course. But my wife doesn't attend this church. Of course, neither do I. but we hooked up with him, and he was happy to have us go with them. So that was kind of, you know, the story behind getting this going.
So what are the kinds of supplies that your group brought as you were on this, I guess, interfaith mission, you might say?
Yeah, there was a lot of clothes, which we spent an evening sorting and folding prior to packing them on the truck to be driven out to Texas. And like I said, there was a lot of toothpaste, toothbrush, soap, shampoo, underwear, toys, shoes, all kinds of those kinds of things. So
while being mindful of the privacy of the individuals that were receiving these kind of items and support, were there any stories that made a particular impact on you? That just sounds like the kind of things that you would bring for just general purposes. Was there anything that stuck out in your mind?
Yeah. Well, there was a couple of things. I think the first thing was that after the first day, we got there and we basically unloaded the truck that we brought the first day and started handing out stuff and sorting stuff. They had a fairly big building in like a downtown area, and it's like the first floor was where they served all of these people. They, you know, got them bus tickets and plane tickets, and they gave them all the clothes and stuff. And then the second floor was this like warehouse area. And so, you know, we're up there unloading the boxes and moving them to appropriate places in the warehouse and sorting the clothes again to get downstairs. And the thing was, we took a 24 foot truck, I think, and it was probably about half full, maybe a little more. And by the end of the day, by my estimate, we had given out an equivalent amount of stuff to what we had brought there to donate. So, you know, that big a truck was basically one day's worth of stuff for them.
Am I correct in assuming that once these folks come out of these facilities, they have basically nothing?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, really nothing. We were able to talk to a couple of the people, you know, via a translator. I don't speak Spanish. And they pretty much all spoke Spanish. And we got, you know, they told us things like they felt like they were relatively well treated, but when you asked them about details, you know, where did you sleep in the detention center? Well, we slept on the floor. Were the lights on all the time? Yes, 24 hours a day. What was the temperature like? Oh, it was freezing all the time. So they were, it is treated as if they are in prison. It has all of those hallmarks. And they took, you know, for whatever reason, I don't know if they came with other material possessions or anything else, but they took everything from them that could be taken, basically, including like belts and shoelaces. Again, like a prison hallmark, right? They couldn't have the shoelaces in the detention center.
All right.
And so they didn't give them back to them when they left. I guess they just get thrown away or something. So we had a lot of shoelaces that we could just give to the people if their shoes were still in good shape. And, you know, one of the guys that we talked to, we asked him, like, you know, what do you have with you? Do you have anything coming out of the detention center? And he reached in his pocket and he pulled out, you know, maybe 10 or 12 coins that he had. And that was it. You know, everything else he had gotten, I mean, besides the clothes that he was wearing, you know, he got at the shelter. So it was pretty much a complete reset button, you know, when they hit the detention center.
And now you talked about bringing things like diapers and toys. Did you see mostly Yes. single individuals, or were there groups of families?
Yeah, maybe, excuse me, maybe half and half. The three individuals that we talked to were families or came with family members. One guy came with his 17-year-old son, and they were just looking for work to send. They had left his wife and three other siblings. We talked to people from El Salvador, from Ecuador, Nicaragua. I didn't meet anybody from Mexico. I mean, I imagine there was probably some there, but they were, you know, more from countries farther south. There was another woman there who talked to us, and she had come over. She was 19 years old, and she had come over with her husband and her one-year-old daughter. And we asked her, you know, what was the motivation for leaving, coming up here? And she was from Ecuador, and she said that she was afraid of her daughter being stolen at 1 year old. And then, like, a day or two later, I talked to somebody who independently brought up this child stealing issue and said that in Ecuador, they do, in fact, steal children, and they go for, I guess, for adoption, you know, for anywhere between $10,000 and $25,000. So, you know, she's just trying to make sure that her daughter is safe by coming here. And in order to do that, they had to, you know, walk for weeks or months to get to the border and then cross the river. You know, we talked to a couple of people. You know, she was one of these people who had to carry their children in chest high water across the river. And as soon as they Wow. started describing that, of course, all I could think of was that picture that we all now know from a couple of weeks ago in the news, right, of the guy and his daughter who drowned in the river. That's what they're doing to get across.
Certainly sounds really impactful, both for those that are volunteering, but certainly for those that are experiencing this journey to, Yeah. you know, the States, where, you know, we would hope folks would be welcomed and supported. And I, on a personal note, I'm incredibly grateful that there are individuals and organizations that are doing this relief support, even in, you know, that have been doing it for long since before a lot of the news media started looking at ICE and Customs and Border Yeah. Protection, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was quite an operation, I have to tell you. We saw probably about 300 to 400 families each day that we were there, which translates into about, you know, 700, anywhere between 700 and 1200 people, something like that, that come through the shelter. And that shelter has a full-time employment list of 5 people, and everybody else who comes there, everybody else who's working there, is somebody who's volunteered. And of course, we were there with 13 people there for 2 days, which was, I'm sure, was very helpful to them. But there were also, we met a couple of people there who they were actually related to the lady who founded that shelter, but they had come all the way over from Spain for a couple of weeks to volunteer at the shelter. So that was pretty extraordinary, I thought.
With so many people feeling such a sense of urgency surrounding the treatment of migrants entering the U.S. and everything that comes down alongside with that, in your opinion, what's important to know and prepare for before diving, like, headlong into actions or support on behalf of these folks?
Yeah, I think that we do have to be cautious about what we accept as truth from the news. I would not be surprised if some of the worst stories that we've heard in the news are true. However, I think that they are probably rare, and that the normal is, well, at least for this one detention center, you know, as I said, the people we talked to, they provided a uniform story about, you know, not being abused. However, it was prison-like. You know, they were there for pretty much 3 days was the length of time they spent at the detention center. Some less, some more. So, you know, I think just that, you know, being cautious about what we accept as truth in the news is a good policy.
Would you say that it's also a good idea to be careful what we allow to become normalized?
Oh, absolutely. I don't even know where to begin with that. But yes, I don't want this kind of situation, even as a relatively benign situation, to continue. I think that there's so much more that we as the United States can do to improve the situation without being harsh and without, you know, building walls. And, you know, certainly the family separations, we didn't see any of that. But, I mean, that's just inhumane. And any of that that's still going on needs to stop, should not be normalized ever.
So do you think, like on this motivation for getting to this shelter in particular, how would you say your values as a secular humanist play in motivating you in particular?
Well, there was a couple of reasons that I think I wanted to go. One was to, like this pastor who kind of sponsored this trip, to see for myself, you know, what was going on. We couldn't get into the detention center. We did try. We went up to the detention center. We said, can we go and look around? They said no. We were able to, like I said, volunteer at the shelter and meet a few of these people. And to see for ourselves again what was going on. The second thing is, I think just hearing the stories that we've heard, some of the stories that we've heard through the news, and wanting to be able to help ourselves. And, you know, it is a long way to go for somebody from Florida, but I mean, there were people from Spain there as well, but you know, it feels good to be able to do something, to help out there. And, the people who were going through there, they seemed appreciative of what we were doing.
Oh, I was just going to ask if like religion, yeah, was, you know, brought up in any of the interactions that you had with either with the other volunteers, yeah, or with the individuals that were receiving support.
Well, this is one of the reasons that I was interested in going with this group. We had agreed to go on this trip. And that night I said that we were folding, sorting clothes, you know, before we packed truck to start driving out here, or driving out to McAllen. The pastor took a few moments to talk to everybody who was going to go on the flights in a couple of days after that. And, you know, what he said was, you know, we're doing this because there are people in need, not for any other reason. They never mentioned proselytizing to them, never mentioned anything like that. It was focused entirely on the fact that there were people who were suffering. And I was, you know, when he said that, of course, I was doubly glad that I was going with this particular group. While we were there, I did not observe anything like that, any kind of proselytizing or anything. The people who were coming through seemed to be, you know, at least a majority Catholic, which makes sense. I think, you know, the South American countries are pretty Catholic countries. And but the focus was simply to help out. And so I was really happy about that.
I think there's something really incredible about that particular action and movement and calling. You know, when we as atheists and secularists look at many charities that are religiously based, we have either firsthand or, you know, heard of others experiencing, you know, you are able to receive these kinds of services, but you must pray with us, or you must weather the volunteers telling you that you should get right with Jesus. And to hear that that wasn't the motivation of the individuals on your trip, and it, you know, was just sort of this, this humanity focus, I think is really uplifting for me to hear as well. Because I tend to be skeptical and very cautious about religious organizations doing charity.
Yeah.
It's incredible what we can accomplish when we decide to just come together and see a need and try to fill that need.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, like I said, there were probably five full-time employees, but I, you know, I'm guessing that there was 20 or 30 volunteers there on any given day.
Well, Joseph, how can people learn more about the shelter that you volunteered at?
Yeah, I don't have their website offhand, but it was Catholic Charities was the shelter. It was the name on the side of the building, and it seemed to be right in downtown McAllen, Texas. And
we'll include it on our show notes on atheist.radio. And if people want to keep up with your activism or the community in Central Florida of freethinkers there, where would I point our listeners to?
Anything on social media, just add the tag CFL Freethought. So we do have a website, cflfreethought.org. We're on Facebook at CFL Freethought, on Twitter, and a couple others. And you can, I mean, I'm on Facebook too, so you can find me and follow me.
Joseph Richardson, thank you so much for joining us. Joseph is an active member of Central Florida Freethought community, working on all kinds of projects. And I'm so glad that you are with us today to talk about the trip that you and your wife returned from in McAllen, Texas, volunteering to support sheltered migrants applying for residency and asylum in the U.S.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. We'll be back after the break. And welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. So when we're thinking about some of those experiences that Joseph had talked with us about in terms of working with folks of multiple faiths, some pluralistic, you know, groups coming together and helping those in need, you know, it makes me hopeful for humanity that, you know, I certainly don't believe that we all must be atheists to improve the world. As long as you have your faith and you're not trying to infringe upon others, and we can see the common humanity and work for that, I'm good with that. I've got no quarrel with you. So, you know, you might think, hearing from Joseph, that that religious people might be, on the whole, very accepting of others in need. Like, you know, fleeing war-torn countries and hoping to relocate in the United States. But, oh no, guys, I've got news for you. Because the Pew Research Center recently brought attention to data from a 2018 survey by tweeting figures showing that white evangelical Christian Americans are the least likely subgroup to say that our country has a responsibility to accept refugees at only 25%. Black Protestants and religiously unaffiliated individuals of all races had very high support for accepting refugees at 63 and 65% respectively. And 71% of those with the highest levels of educational attainment believe that the U.S. should accept refugees. Catholics of any race were evenly split on the issue, reflecting the overall trend of roughly half of Americans saying that the U.S. has a responsibility to accept refugees. And along political party lines, 2017 to 2018 saw Republican support for refugees drop from 35% to 26%.
There it is. That's the Trump effect right there.
It's really amazing. And right now we're talking in this study about refugees, which is different from an asylum seeker and different from a migrant who wishes to get residency status in the United States. These are folks that have been classified by the United Nations as coming from areas through that have been affected by war, by strife, by climate change, and have been displaced and are in need of being relocated to another place where they can be safe and thrive. And you have evangelical Christian Americans that are white, that only one in four people think that, yeah, this is something that that we are morally responsible for. It's a very difficult thing for me to fathom. What would motivate you to believe that way?
I mean, not exclusively, I do want to say, but it's specifically a Christian tenet to take care of those around you, especially those who are not in a position of privilege. I mean, that's some of the language in the Bible that is least prone to interpretation.
A lot of New Testament stuff, too, in each of the Gospels, yes, as far as I'm familiar.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it turns out a lot of religious traditions have a lot of things to say about how we ought to treat the worst off amongst us. And there's something else outside of the religion that's leading some people who call themselves evangelical Christians to have a different opinion.
Hey, I believe in the right for people to self-identify, so I'm not going to do any of this so-called evangelical Christians. You think that you're an evangelical Christian? Great. I'm going to take you at your word. I have no reason to doubt you.
I don't know, maybe cherry picking which parts of the Bible they want to pay attention to.
One can say that the help the neighbor and the orphan and the widow is as long as they're part of your group. Mm-hmm. And I think that what this aligns to is that, you know, the majority of refugees entering the United States don't look or sound like white evangelical Americans.
Mm-hmm. And even though they're probably mostly Christians or Catholics.
Well, I mean, it really could depend from many different areas of the world. And you do have a very large number of Muslim refugees from, you know, Somalia and Sudan and you know, you have minority religious individuals in all parts of the world that are coming to the U.S. But because you look and sound different, we don't really have a responsibility to accept you. That's what this figure is saying, that 3 out of 4 white evangelical Americans are of that mindset. And the overlap between Republicans, where that figure in at least 2018 was nearly identical to white evangelical Christians and Republicans, it's 1 in 4 that only think that that we have that responsibility to accept
25% and 26%.
Yep.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Well, it calls to mind, you know, something that we've been thinking about on the show, where we say, you know, we've been noticing where you know, individual religious people or certain religious movements seem to have finally had enough with racialized rhetoric, with white supremacy, with really
the politics of hate.
Yeah, politics of hate. I couldn't say it better. And one of the things that we're noticing is certain groups really finally coming out against that and uniting with what many atheists and humanists feel. And one thing that caught my eye was newspapers across the country last week carrying an opinion piece from the leaders of the National Cathedral in D.C. condemning Donald Trump's racialized rhetoric, that was their words, and noting that African-American leaders have led the way in rightfully expressing outrage, but others have remained silent or downplayed the racial overtones of his attacks. And the faith leaders recall the historical moment when Senator Joseph McCarthy was called to account for his cruel and reckless attacks, when, U.S. Army Attorney Joseph Welsh asked, "Have you no sense of decency?" This is a big famous moment in the mid-50s that was televised during the McCarthy hearings. And this attorney said, "Have you no decency?" And so the leaders of the church rhetorically asked the nation, "Have we no sense of decency?" They call on religious individuals to boldly stand witness against bigotry, hatred, intolerance, and xenophobia, especially when it comes to the highest offices of this nation. The Episcopal leaders urge all to take every opportunity to oppose indecency and dehumanization that is racism, whether it comes to us through words or actions.
I'm really glad that they did this, that they finally stood up and said something. I mean, there have been a lot of people, and like you said, individual people who have been standing up and saying something about this, just small voices in the dark. It's really heartening to see that they're coming together as a group and saying, hey, no, actually, we are not okay with this. And we are not okay with this direction.
Yeah, and this is... I'm also really glad that this is happening. It makes it so that I think this will be a more approachable position for other people, because you know, when you're a Christian and only the atheists and only the progressives are saying, well, right, Donald Trump is a, you know, he's a racist bigot, everyone, and then it's really tough for them to accept it. But when they have now their own people that are also saying it, now we can really have a unified front.
Right.
Well, and the Episcopal movement, you know, denomination in the U.S. is a fairly, you know,
progressive.
Yeah, it's fairly progressive and a not insignificant branch of Christian, you know, adherence in the U.S. And even those that aren't Episcopal will look to the cathedral leaders as sort of pseudo-spiritual guides, because although the National Cathedral isn't associated with, like, our government at all, you know, it's not supported and run by that, it is the place that has held numerous state funerals for presidents and memorial services for presidents. It's the big gathering places for, like, the day after official government, you know, inauguration ceremonies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's often a big ceremony that's like a prayer blessing for the president after, you know, inauguration things. So, and it has been for decades. And so to have those leaders saying, we reject this, those leaders of that cathedral welcomed Donald Trump the day after his inauguration to pray for a good, prosperous, and excellent, you know, presidency. And they're doing an about face and saying, no, you know, we've got to. And I like that they credit African-American leaders and spiritual leaders that have been.
This is not their first rodeo.
Yes, exactly. So I think that it's really important. And one thing that one of my people in my Facebook network had said, and brought to attention, this is Rebecca Hensler, who is in the Bay Area, and many atheist listeners know her for founding Grief Beyond Belief Network, which is something to support atheists and non-believers dealing with all sorts of grief in non-religious ways. She's really brought attention to, hey, if you're on social media, click on those ads and click on those links and share those links, because it gets it in front of more eyes. And those kinds of clicks are important for the media outlets to look at that and say, hey, these are what people are clicking on. Therefore, it's producing more ad revenue. Therefore, it behooves us as a media company to highlight these kinds of stories.
Yeah.
Highlight the stories that say, no, we reject this rhetoric. We reject racism. We fight against it.
Yeah, it gears the algorithm to there are a lot of good things that do happen. It's just that we don't tend to notice all that much when things are going right or when things are good. Like when with this move right here with this the cathedral, they're doing something that's good, but it's not going to get the same kind of boosted signal as...
Well, it's not shocking as... Yeah,
it's like the president isn't supposed to be saying racist things. And it's like, oh, the president said more racist things. So it's like, what did he say this time? That kind of drives traffic that way. And unfortunately, under capitalism, that's how money gets made.
Well, there's another group that has been joining this fight in a somewhat adjacent way. A diverse group has penned an open letter under the banner of Christians Against Christian Nationalism. Endorsers include leaders of Catholic, Methodist, Baptist, and other evangelical Protestant organizations and movements who contend that Christian nationalism distorts America's constitutional democracy as well as the Christian faith, merges Christian and American identities, and provides a cover for white supremacy and racial subjugation. The Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, whose mission is to protect religious liberty for all and defend the separation of church and state, produced the letter in response to what they see as a spike in Christian nationalist rhetoric and efforts to pass state-level legislation that reflects Christian nationalist ideology. And the letter now has more than 6,000 signatories. This is amazing. And we've talked about this, Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. It's one that you don't typically think of as being associated with Baptists, right? When I think Baptists, I've got an image in my head. You know, it's a strict separation of the genders with fixed gender roles and women wearing long dresses and railing against, you know, Avril Lavigne's music or something like that.
Yeah. No, well, if they're even listening to music.
Well, you don't need to listen to it to know that it's the devil and you should rail against it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But, or like the Westboro Baptist will pop into your head.
Yeah, kind of yeah, just because of the name association. But this is really cool. I mean, we as atheists and humanists, you know, we'll often look at Freedom From Religion Foundation or Military Religious Freedom Foundation or Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. And those are typically associated with atheists specifically. Mm. And these folks in the Baptist, group for religious liberty, these are the folks that the term secularist can apply to. They are secularists.
Yeah.
Just like the pastor that's helping out, you know, bring people, you know, people in, you know, across faiths to go bring them and help out immigrants in Texas, right? That's purely secular. He's helping people out because they're people, and that comes first, and that should be respected.
Yeah. It's very important that people know, like, even though this is obviously an atheist or a secular humanist show, when we talk about Christian evangelicism or like Dominionists and that kind of thing, it's one very specific and narrow type of faith that's trying to pull off this whole Christian nationalism thing.
It's one specific faith and one little narrow slice that, in my opinion, and the opinion of an increasing number of Christians, has way too much power altogether.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
To wit, we look at a callback to last week when we were talking about sort of the history of In God We Trust and these bills that are being pushed at the state level legislation. That's what we mean by Christian nationalism. That's what we're seeing as Christian nationalism.
Yeah, when they're pushing for power, they're pushing when they're trying for power and shielding themselves under the moniker of Christian or under evangelical. They're trying to use the big umbrella to get in the door, but once they're in the door and they hold the power, there's going to be a very specific range of things that we're going to be allowed to believe. If they're allowed to get there, the people who are also under that umbrella, they recognize these people because they have seen them for the loons that we have seen them for. That's what this move here is it's calling that out. It's like, hey, you're going for a power grab. Knock it off.
I want to bring attention to another calling out of these folks. And this is an atheist one. Let's go down to Texas, because an educational seminar on the national motto hosted by Metroplex Atheist last week in Fort Worth, Texas, drew around 200 attendees, as well as a handful of protesters, you know, naturally. The event had received plenty of attention beforehand due to the group's novel publicity campaign, which involved hanging bright yellow banners stating, "In no God we trust." from downtown Fort Worth's light posts. Even the city's mayor tweeted that while respecting free speech was important, she was appalled by the message. Group President Courtney Stewart and secularist activist Aaron Raw spoke about the exclusionary and divisive nature of the motto that suggests that non-believers aren't full members of our democracy.
We addressed this a little bit in last week's episode when we were talking about some of the court's rationale behind having In God We Trust as not a specifically Christian thing.
Oh, yeah, it's just ceremonial. It's lost all of its meaning.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just so ceremonial. Says the court.
Lost all its meaning. Sure, sure. But the city's mayor tweeted that, oh, yeah, we have to respect free speech, but this was appalled. She was appalled by this message. If it's just ceremonial, why is she appalled?
Although
it's not ceremonial.
You know, now we got, you know, now we got our sensibilities, you know, all right. Tingling. So,
yeah,
I mean, this in some way, this is a feedback loop. If I, you know, whenever we hear of people that are pushing out a message that's anti-Christian or at least secular, and it riles up the...
Hey, there's a difference between secular and anti-Christian.
Well,
don't feed them.
Well, I'm just saying, but anytime you see something...
it's provocative to say, in no God we trust.
Right, and it's...
Granted.
And when they come out and say, that's appalling, good. Like, that's a feedback loop that tells us that we're doing the right things. You know, we also have a battle of making these normal things become normal so that, you know, we're also part of this narrative. We're not just some marginal group that aren't Americans. Like you know, Aaron Ross talked about this multiple times before with the Motto Project. And with, you know, some related things that, no, we're real Christians despite what, you know, Ronald Reagan or George Bush or other people want to like rail against atheists aren't real Americans. No, we are real Americans, and
yeah,
it's important.
I don't have any problem with people who have a religious faith. I don't really care what their religious faith is. Just keep it inside of your holy place. Keep it inside of your house. And like, can we just have a public space that is just a public space?
Yeah. If you're a pastor and you have good views and you can go and do good things with other people of other faiths, I can respect you.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Like, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, but this mayor who's calling this appalling, it's like, it's too on the nose. It's too, this mayor is obviously not understanding what the point is of this.
When you say that the message appalls you, you're saying that the belief appalls you, that those who don't have faith in a God or trust in a God are by our very existence appalling.
Right.
And when you have those start to be those little whistle words, those little sentiments that start alienating individuals, whether they be of people of different beliefs, different faiths, different races, different national origins. And we've got to be more like the secularists, whether they be Baptist secularists or atheist secularists, to say no, enough already. Justin, Nathan, thank you so much for joining
me
today.
Absolutely.
We want to thank Joseph Richardson of Central Florida Freethought. You can find us at atheist.radio. Give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC and find us all on social media. Our music is by Chris Coleman and Phil Whitfield. See you guys next week.